These podcasts are brought to you by the U.S. Fund for UNICEF's End Trafficking Project.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. I'm Emily Pazak-Lapchik, and I'm the Program Officer for the End Trafficking Program at the U.S. Fund for UNICEF. Our goals are to raise awareness about child trafficking and mobilize communities such as yourselves to take action against it.
Hello, and thank you for tuning into our podcast. I'm Tori Corbello with the U.S. Fund for UNICEF's End Trafficking Project. Today we're going to be discussing the demand for human trafficking and what organizations like UNICEF are doing to address it, but most importantly, what you guys can do in your own daily lives to help reduce the demand for human trafficking all around the world. So human trafficking is a business, and it operates on the principles of supply and demand. So there is a huge demand for the commercial sex industry and for cheap goods and therefore cheap labor. There is also very little risk involved, so that means they are rarely getting caught, and so there are traffickers who are willing to meet the demand, even if it's at the expense of other human beings. So with me today is Emily and Malia. They're going to start off the discussion. So Malia, can you briefly talk about the demand for commercial sex and how it's connected to human trafficking?
Absolutely, Tori. So the demand for commercial sex comes from the buyers of sex, and these buyers of sex are commonly called Johns, and Johns are buying boys and men and girls and women of all ages and all races all over our country every single day. And to give you a clear picture of what that really looks like, I want to dive into a little bit of a case study of the buyers of sex themselves. So the average victim of sex trafficking in our country, first and foremost, are U.S. citizens, female, with average age of entry being anywhere from 11 years old to 14 years old. Now, I want to give you a case study of Kimmy. Kimmy is a minor U.S. citizen who is a sex trafficking victim, and she is forced to see 5 men a night, a nightly quota that is imposed by her trafficker, her pimp. So let's switch the gears and talk about those buyers of sex. Those Johns that she's being seen, 5 men a day, you multiply those buyers of sex for that one night by 1 week, and you get 35 buyers of sex that are exploiting Kimmy for her body on just 1 week alone. You multiply that number by 52 weeks, and in a single given year, you have 1,820 Johns that have sexually exploited a minor for her body and for sex. That is what the demand looks like in our country.
Thanks, Malia. So, Emily, can you talk about the demand for consumer products and how that's connected to human trafficking?
Absolutely, Tori. You know, unfortunately, just by living and breathing in this world and being consumers, we're inevitably connected to the lives of exploited people all throughout the globe. And particularly over the last few decades, our consumer habits have changed dramatically. People are buying more products more often and are wanting to replace them more quickly than they ever have before. And unfortunately, this large demand for cheap goods has inevitably created a demand for cheap labor, and this often results in exploitation such as human trafficking. This demand is created for products like the technology that we use, the food that we eat every day, the clothes that we wear, and the buildings that we work and live in. And this extends to many products throughout our globe.
What are some of the strategies being used to address supply and demand? Malia, would you like to start with that?
Sure, Tori. I mean, at the end of the day, if there wasn't such a large demand for commercial sex, sex trafficking just simply wouldn't exist in the way and the extent that it does today. So this reality highlights the need for continued efforts to enact policies and promote cultural norms that simply prohibit paying bodies for sex. And so one example of this would be the Nordic model. And the Nordic model is essentially the world's very first human rights-based legal approach to ending human trafficking. It was created in Sweden in 1999, and it's also called the Swedish model or the Swedish approach. But from this point on, I'll call it the Nordic model. And it's essentially the world's very first law to recognize, first and foremost, that prostitution is violence against women and it's a violation of human rights. And it really creates 3 different policies in order to ensure that women are not being exploited for sex. So how does it do this? It first and foremost, decriminalizes the selling of sex and ensures that women and men and boys and girls are being treated as victims rather than criminals of this issue. Secondly, it created public awareness campaigns in order to educate people about the harsher penalties that were going to be put in place for Johns, for buyers, for pimps, and for traffickers. And in turn, it really ended up decreasing the amount of people that went out and bought bodies for sex because they knew and were aware and were educated through the public awareness campaigns of the penalties that were going to be in place for them if they were to buy someone for sex. And most importantly than anything else, the Nordic model created exit programs for individuals who wish to exit the life. And this is extremely important when you think of all individuals, whether you're a woman or a man or a boy or a girl who has been forced into prostitution as your livelihood. And in order to leave the life, you need an exit strategy and an exit program to create a new livelihood moving forward. And that's exactly what the Nordic model did. So this is a really great example of an approach that is now being streamlined to other countries all around the world in order to end the sexual exploitation of women and men and boys and girls.
So, Emily, what are some of the strategies being used to address supply and demand in regard to labor trafficking?
So on a global scale, it's estimated that about 168 million children are involved in child labor around the world today, and about 85 million are involved in hazardous forms of work, which means they're working in dangerous factories, they might be working in the sex industry and prostitution, all places that we know children shouldn't be. And this prevents them from having a childhood, from living with their family oftentimes, and from receiving an education. So UNICEF works on a global scale to address issues like child labor under their child protection lens, and they do this in two main ways. One is through strengthening systems, and one is through addressing harmful social norms. So working with governments and policymakers, UNICEF makes sure that there are policies in place to help protect children from harmful forms of child labor. And on a community level, UNICEF is working with leaders, faith-based leaders, and others in the community to help them understand the harms of child labor and help them understand the importance of sending children to school rather than just working, perhaps to support the agriculture and the farm that the family works on. And sometimes UNICEF even works to provide incentives to families so that the children can attend school instead of working. So UNICEF really takes this comprehensive approach in order to reduce both the supply and the demand for trafficking.
Great. Thanks, Emily. So, Malia, what can audience members do to help reduce the demand for trafficking?
Audience members can educate their communities and change the dialogue. It's as simple as really doing a Google search and seeing what type of anti-trafficking organizations are within your area or within your state that are doing different types of educational and awareness campaigns, maybe that are even directed to young men to change the dialogue and educate them about the realities of sex trafficking and of prostitution and of buying sex and watching pornography or going to the strip clubs near where they live. For instance, an organization called CASE in Chicago does exactly that. And so I urge everyone to really look at that resource and really see what they're doing in order to get more information. And also, it's as easy as changing the dialogue. It's as easy as when you're with a group of friends or when you're with your peers or your coworkers or your family and they use the word pimp or pimping and they glamorize it to really challenge the notion of what that means. Because at the end of the day, a pimp is not a cool guy that we want to aspire to be or that we want our friends to dress up at for Halloween. A pimp is a trafficker and someone that is exploiting the most vulnerable people in our country and in our cities. And it's important to really change the dialogue and to challenge the dialogue that you hear being used within your friends and your families. That's really the first step.
Great. And Emily, do you want to talk about some take actions in regard to labor trafficking?
Yeah, so the good news is that because we are all connected through the products that we buy, it also means that we all have the power to vote with our dollar and choose products that are making that are paying people a living wage. So there are several tools that can help you identify companies that are doing the right thing and also help you ensure that the products that you're buying are made by people who are working freely. The first is slaveryfootprint.org, and if you visit this website, it's a quick survey. It takes about 15 minutes to fill out, and you input aspects of your lifestyle, like the food that you eat, the clothes that you have, the home that you live in, and it calculates about how many slaves you have working for you. And it's not fun to find out that number, but it also then gives you pre-written letters to hundreds of companies so that you can ask them what they're doing to address slavery and trafficking in their supply chains. Another great tool is Free2Work, and this resource rates companies to ensure that there is no slavery or trafficking in their supply chains. So it has four different questions in four different categories on policies, transparency and traceability, monitoring and training, and also workers' rights. So this tool really puts the power in the hands of consumers to look at how their favorite brands have been rated and then make decisions based on that. And finally, there's a certification process called Fair Trade that ensures that no slave or child labor was used in the production of products. So most commonly, you'll see this on products like coffee or tea or sugar, or my favorite is chocolate. And I think if you just choose one product and try and go Fair Trade with that one product that you eat the most, then it can really make an impact on people's lives around the globe.
Thank you both for speaking to this issue. It was really great to hear some of your insights. I also want to thank our listeners at home for tuning in. We'll see you guys next time. For more information, check out unicefusa.org/endtrafficking.